Patients in persistent vegetative state, or PVS as it is called for short, seem to be awake because their eyes are open. Yet they show no awareness or responsiveness to the outside world. They are conscious, some would say, but there is no content to their consciousness. They have become an empty shell. There is nobody at home. Yet recent research with functional brain scans shows this is not always the case. Some of these patients, despite being mute and unresponsive, seem to have some kind of activity going on in their brains, and some kind of awareness of the outside world. It is not, however, at all clear what it means. Are they in some kind of perpetual dream state? Or are they in heaven, or in hell, or just dimly aware with only a fragment of consciousness of which they themselves are scarcely aware? There have been several high-profile court cases in recent years as to whether treatment that keeps these people alive, since they cannot eat or drink, should be withdrawn or not, whether they should be left to die or not. In several cases, the judges decided that it was reasonable to withdraw treatment and let the vegetative patients die. This does not happen quickly. Instead, the law, solemn and absurd, insists that the patients are slowly starved and dehydrated to death, a process that will take several days. I finished my outpatient clinic at 8 and drove out of London in the early autumnal evening. It was quite late by the time I reached the neurologist's home. He drove me in his own car to the nursing home a few miles away. This was a pleasant country house, surrounded by tall and ancient trees. It was night by now, and once we had parked the car, I could see the friendly lights of the nursing home through the dark branches of the trees as we walked across a derelict tennis court covered in dry, fallen leaves. The home was run by Catholic nuns and devoted to people with catastrophic brain damage. Inside, all was clean and tidy, and the staff clearly very caring and friendly. The contrast with the hospital where I had carried out the shunt operation a year earlier could not have been greater. The devout Catholic staff did not accept the grave lesson of neuroscience, that everything we are depends upon the physical integrity of our brains. Instead, their ancient faith in an immaterial human soul meant that they could create a kind and caring home for these vegetative patients and their families. The sister took me up a grand staircase to see my patient. I wondered who had lived in the house originally, an Edwardian capitalist, perhaps, or lesser aristocrat, with a small army of servants. I wondered what he would have thought of the use to which his imposing home had now been put. On the first floor, there was a wide carpeted corridor which we walked down, passing many patients in their rooms on either side. The doors were all open, and through the doorways I could see the motionless forms of the patients in their beds. Beside each door was an enamelled plaque with the patient's name. Because they are there for so many years, until they die, they can have proper plaques rather than just the paper labels you find in an ordinary hospital. To my dismay, I recognized at least five of the names as former patients of mine. One of the senior neurosurgeons who trained me, and a man I revere, told me a story once of the famous knighted surgeon with whom he, in his turn, had served as an apprentice. He used to remove acoustic tumors with a periosteal elevator, an instrument normally used for opening the skull, he told me. An operation that would take most surgeons many hours took him 30 or 40 minutes. Inevitably, this would sometimes lead to disaster. I remember one woman with a large acoustic. He caught the vertebral artery with the elevator, and there was torrential hemorrhage. The woman was obviously done for. I had to close up, and that was that. Nevertheless, I always had to ring him up every evening at 7 o'clock on the dot to let him know how all the patients were doing. So I went through the list of all the inpatients. At the end, I mentioned the woman with an acoustic. Mrs. B, she was called. I can still remember the name. "Mrs. B is slipping away," I said, or words to that effect. "Mrs. B," he said, "who's that?" He had forgotten her already. "I wish I had a memory like that," my boss said wistfully. "Great surgeons," he then added, "tend to have bad memories." I hope I'm a good surgeon, but I'm certainly not a great surgeon. It's not the successes I remember, or so I like to think, but the failures. But here, in the nursing home, were several patients I had already forgotten. Some of them were people I had simply been unable to help. But there was at least one man who, as my juniors put it in their naive and tactless way, I had wrecked. I had ill-advisedly operated on him many years earlier for a large tumour in a spirit of youthful enthusiasm. The operation had gone on for 18 hours, and I had inadvertently torn the bacilla artery at 2 in the morning. This is the artery that supplies the brain stem, and he never woke up again. I saw his grey, curled-up body in its bed. I would never have recognised him were it not for the enamelled plaque with his name by the door. The patient I had come to see lay mute and immobile, limbs rigid, her eyes open in an expressionless face. She had been a journalist for a local newspaper, full of life and energy, but had then suffered the hemorrhage which caused the damage which my operation could not undo. There were happy, smiling photographs of her before this terrible event on the walls around the room. She made occasional mewling sounds. It took me only a few minutes to test the shunt by putting a needle into it through the skin of her scalp and establish that it was working. There was nothing I could do to help. She communicated, apparently, via a Morse code buzzer, as it seemed that she could move one finger. A nurse was sitting beside her and patiently listened to the bleeping sounds, concentrating very hard with a slight frown. She interpreted them for me. The patient asked me, the nurse explained, about the shunt, and then she thanked me and wished me good night. Her mother was there and came out of the room with me, accosting me a little desperately in the wide corridor outside. We spoke for a while. She talked about letters that her daughter had been sending, transcribed by one of the nurses from her Morse code bleeping. She expressed some doubts as to whether her daughter had really said the things transcribed by the nurses. There is no way of knowing, of course. The woman's mother lives in a nightmare, a labyrinth of uncertainty and of hopeless love, her daughter both alive and dead. Behind her daughter's rigid, expressionless face, is she in fact awake? Is she aware, in some way, of what is going on outside her paralysed body? Are the nurses inventing her letters, wittingly or unwittingly? Does their faith deceive them? Can we ever know? Chapter 20. Hubris, noun, arrogant pride or presumption. In Greek tragedy, excessive pride towards or defiance of the gods, leading to nemesis. I went to Marks and Spencer in Wimbledon in the morning and bought a box full of fruit and chocolates for the theatre staff. I had gone through my CD collection and picked out enough discs to last at least all day and much of the night, as the operation was going to be a long one. I had only been a consultant for 4 years, but I already knew I had a very large practice, larger than any other neurosurgeons I knew. The patient was a schoolteacher in his late 50s, tall and bespectacled, who walked with a stick and was a little stooped. He had been seen by a local neurologist who had arranged a brain scan, and as a result he had been sent to see me. It was in the days of the old hospital, and I saw him in my office, with its row of windows looking out onto a little copse of birch trees. One of the local foxes would sometimes look in at me with a thoughtful expression as it passed by. I sat the patient down in the chair by my desk, with his wife and son next to him, and took the films of his brain scans, which he had brought with him, over to the viewing box on the wall. Computers were still a long way away. I already knew what the scans would show, but I was still startled by the sheer size of the tumour growing from the base of his skull. All of the brainstem and the cranial nerves, the nerves for hearing, movement, sensation for the face, and for swallowing and talking, were stretched over its sinister, humpbacked mass. It was an exceptionally large petroclival meningioma. I had only seen tumours this size before in the textbooks. In later years, I was to see many such in Ukraine, when patients with terrible tumours from all over the country would come to seek my opinion. I was not sure whether to feel excited or alarmed. I went back to my